Hannah, Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Protesters rally in the U.S. city of Minneapolis ahead of the trial of an officer for the death of George Floyd, a black man who died in police custody in 2020. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry condemns Israel's expansionist policy and plans for annexing a large part of the occupied West Bank. Worldwide rallies mark International Women's Day, with some countries witnessing clashes between demonstrators and security forces. It's good to have you. Our top story, people have held a rally in the U.S. city of Minneapolis ahead of a trial of an officer involved in the choking death of African-American George Floyd. Black Lives Matter activists demanded justice for the man who died at the hands of Derek Chauvin, a white police officer, in May 2020. Video footage showed Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes while the victim pleading not being able to breathe. The trial was set for Monday but was put off for at least a day after a higher court ordered the judge to consider adding an additional murder charge. The officer is now facing second-degree murder and manslaughter charges. Three other officers at the scene are also facing trial. The death of Floyd sparked a flurry of protests against racial injustice and prompted calls for police reform in the U.S. Colin Campbell says people are protesting as they want justice and are tired of decades of disproportionate treatment in the U.S.
What you're seeing and what you're witnessing is the frustration and anxiety and somewhat an expression of hopelessness that there will be justice for George Floyd. And that's because of the precedent that has already been set when we have situations where a police officer kills an unarmed black man and also at times black woman. That police officer or those police officers are acquitted and never face any serious penalty for the loss of life. And so these people are protesting because they want to see justice. They're tired of what has been happening for not just the past several years, mind you, but decades, and some would say centuries, when the start of the beginning of slavery in the U.S., and then when there were slave patrols, and there was probably even less accountability then. There weren't any cell phones recording videos of an encounter by a black person with a white person who may have just killed them simply because they were not deferring to them. They weren't obsequious. They weren't in chains. We don't know, but we do know that this historic nature of disproportionate treatment and the ill treatment coming from many members of the white community to the black community in the United States is historic in nature.
Also in the U.S., the struggle continues to guarantee and respect the vote of minorities, especially African Americans. Despite the Voting Rights Act of 1965, Republicans in state houses around the country are accused by rights groups of working to advance legislation suppressing voting rights. Our correspondent, Ronnie Carvello, tells us more.
Once again, the memory of the famous Bloody Sunday in 1965 is more actual than ever. The 600 civil rights activists that were brutally repressed by state troopers while trying to march for the right to vote in the city of Selma, Alabama, have been remembered this week during its 56th anniversary. This episode forced the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to be approved.
The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed to try to protect the rights of people to vote where they weren't being protected previously. Specifically, there were many states in the southern United States that were putting up barriers to keep African Americans from voting. They would keep them from registering to vote. They would prohibit their access to the polls. They would use violence and intimidation to keep them from voting. And so the Voting Rights Act of 1965 gave power to the federal government, the Department of Justice, to be able to intervene in the local elections to make them more fair.
Voting rights movements indicate that many states continue to violate the act. They say that voters of color are more likely to face long lines at the polls and are disproportionately affected by voter identification laws and limited opportunities to vote by mail. Republicans disagree with this assessment.
This has been controversial for the past 60 years. States make the rules on their elections and they want to maintain those rules. But if they're making rules that are discriminatory and keeping African Americans or other minorities from voting, then there needs to be accountability.
Last Sunday, President Biden signed an order to federal agencies to expand access to voter registration and election information. It also determined that federal agencies develop plans to give federal employees time off to vote or volunteer in no-partition electoral positions. Republicans remind that the president lacks the authority to overturn provisions on voting rights at the state level, like the one recently passed by Georgia's GOP-controlled state house that early voting would require Congress's act. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Carvello.
Brazil's Supreme Court has overturned all convictions against former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Justice Edson Fachin ruled that a court in the city of Curitiba that convicted Lula lacked jurisdiction. The justice has now sent the case to a federal court in the capital, Brasilia. The convictions are related to a probe into a massive corruption scheme centered on Brazil's state oil company, Petrobras. Lula had been accused of taking bribes and channeling illegal funds to his foundation. He had been sentenced to 26 years in jail. Lula spent 18 months in prison before being freed in 2019, pending appeal. The Supreme Court ruling clears the way for Lula to run in the 2022 presidential election. The Palestinian Authority has slammed Israel's plans for constructing new settler units in the occupied West Bank. In a statement, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the regime is pressing ahead with its expansionist agenda aimed at ethnic cleansing and displacing Palestinians. The statement also denounced what it called Israel's intention for implementing plans to annex parts of the occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the ministry welcomed the International Criminal Court's decision to launch an investigation into war crimes committed by the Israeli regime. The ICC is set to probe Palestinian deaths during the 2014 Gaza War and the March of Return rallies, as well as Israel's illegal settlement activities. Political commentators say that Mohsen Abbas says Israel would violate international laws so long as it enjoys the support of the United States and the West.
The system that's actually currently and has been for the last several decades in charge of American policy remains constant, regardless of whether it's Biden, Trump, and all the other, what I describe as levers of power, puppet leaders. There really is very little difference between either Democrats or Republicans when it comes especially to Israel and the exceptionalism that America has for Israel. Israel can continue to violate international law as and how it likes. America certainly won't do anything about it. Biden, again, in this instance of the ICC criminal investigation, is also continuing to dig his heels in. He is not a party to the ICC. America never has been, nor is Israel. And they are obviously not taking what the ICC do seriously, and they're certainly against the inquiry altogether.
Well, Palestinian women in the Gaza Strip have marked the International Women's Day. They held a rally to express solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails without any charges. Ruba Shabit has more in this report.
The Union of Palestinian Women held a protest rally in front of Red Cross in the Gaza Strip to show solidarity with Palestinian detainees, especially women languishing in Israeli jails with no charge. The protest was part of events in the enclave to mark the International Women's Day.
We are expressing our solidarity with all Palestinian women who have sacrificed their life and property for the Palestinian cause. Our prisoners are in danger and we don't know what is happening in Israeli jails. We call on the international community to take actions to save our Palestinian prisoners, especially women.
The Palestinian Prisoner Society said in a statement that 35 female Palestinian prisoners are currently behind Israeli bars, noting that 11 of the prisoners are mothers. The statement said 26 of the female prisoners had been sentenced to varying prison terms, the longest belonging to two prisoners, Shuruq Dawayat and Shatila Abu Ayyad, who are each serving a jail sentence of 16 years.
We mark this day, and we are here to support our female prisoners in Israeli jails. Some of these women have children. They are suffering from serious torture and oppression as Israeli army deprives them of visiting their families. They don't even have access to lawyers. We stress that it's everyone's duty to take actions and release the women.
Israeli army practices physical and psychological torture against Palestinian women arrested in unlivable cells in Israeli jails and prevents their lawyers from visiting them.
On this day, we demand freedom for all Palestinian women. There are about 40 women in Israeli jails. These women are symbols of our revolution. We call on international community to defend the rights of these women.
Statistics show that the number of Palestinian prisoners at Israeli jails reached some 5,000 prisoners, including administrative detainees and women and children.
On the International Women's Day, people here express solidarity with Palestinian women who are detained in Israeli jails with no charge. People call on international community to release these women as soon as possible. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Women in other parts of the world have also held rallies to mark the International Women's Day. In some places, like the Algerian capital, scuffles broke out between marchers and security forces. Algerian women were demanding new rights and the departure of the ruling elite. Demonstrators in the Polish capital also clashed with police. The rally in Warsaw took on added significance months after a constitutional court banned almost all abortions. In the Ukrainian capital Kiev, protesters demanded the authorities ratify laws to combat domestic violence against women. Over 1,000 people also took to the streets of the German capital, Berlin, calling for more gender equality and protection from violence and abuse of women. In Turkey's city of Istanbul, protesters gathered in Taksim Square to call on authorities to prevent violence against women and punish the perpetrators. The controversy over France's treatment of its Muslim community is deepening. French Muslims and rights organizations have complained to the European Commission about France's so-called Imam Charter, the brainchild of President Emmanuel Macron, that they say is the epitome of the country's state-sanctioned Islamophobia and an infringement on their freedoms.
A cry for help for France's more than 3 million Muslims. A letter of complaint signed by a global coalition of 25 civil society organizations and NGOs spanning 11 countries to the President of the European Commission, urging immediate action against France for what they call is its state-sponsored Islamophobia. Renamed the Charter of Principles, the Imam Charter's 10 articles set out the so-called Republican values to which all imams in France should subscribe. Either you're with the Republic, the French president has warned, or you're not with the Republic.
What Macron is trying to do is feed into a narrative that Muslims is a cultural threat to France. And really, the reality is that France, the vast majority of French Muslims are law-abiding citizens. They've been arising socioeconomically in French society, and that is a concern and a threat to the French elite.
The new letter of complaint follows a similar one in January by a coalition of Muslim NGOs to the UN Human Rights Council. The already existing problem of French Islamophobia took a turn for the worse in the wake of the beheading of school teacher Samuel Paty by a Takfiri extremist outside his school in November last year for showing offensive cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad during his class. For the French president, that provided a valuable opportunity. He defended the profane cartoons and introduced legislation targeting so-called Islamic extremism.
So this is entirely cynical. He's using this for political gain. And the reality is, as soon as you start conceding room to the far right, then that normalizes them. So I wouldn't be surprised if he actually loses votes.
The deeply offensive caricatures set off angry protests worldwide. But inside France, a crackdown on the Muslim community. Multiple mosques were forced to close. The country's biggest Muslim charity and an anti-Islamophobia organization were banned. Dozens of people were arrested, and hundreds face deportation. Critics say the recent moves by the French state target Muslims and alienates them. And the French government's attempt at aligning French Islam with Republican values and to combat separatism raises more questions than answers. Saeed Kuriza, London.
The trial of prominent Nigerian Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zakzaki and his wife Zinat has resumed. During the court session in the northwestern Kaduna city, prosecutors presented witness and new evidence against Sheikh Zakzaki. However, the judge adjourned the hearing until March the 31st to allow the prosecutors to close their case. Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife have been in custody since December 2015. The two are being tried for charges including homicide and disruption of public peace, which they reject. Their detention came after the Nigerian army attacked a religious ceremony in the city of Zaria, killing nearly 350 people. Since then, a crackdown has continued on Zakzaki's followers, leading to more killings and arrests. Well, the death toll from a series of explosions at a military camp in Equatorial Guinea has risen to 98. Authorities say at least 615 people were also injured in the blasts at the Nkwantomo military base in the coastal city of Bata on Sunday. Nearly 300 of the wounded people remained hospitalized. President Teodoro Obiang has attributed the accident to negligence that is related to the handling of dynamite stored at a camp. He said the explosions damaged almost all homes and buildings in Bata. The government has also called on people to donate blood, noting that hospitals in the region are overwhelmed. Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko, after being freed from detention, has warned President Macky Sall against running for office beyond the allotted two-term constitutional limit. Here's more.
We demand Macky Sall declare publicly and without ambiguity, this yes-no business is over. A president that neither says yes nor no, where does that lead us? Where is my goodwill? But he should declare publicly and without ambiguity, and the people demand it, that in 2024 he will pack his bags and he will leave, one way or another.
Sonko also called for much larger anti-government protests, but urged his supporters to stay peaceful. President Sall, however, called on people to be calm and avoid confrontation. The country has witnessed days of deadly clashes between opposition supporters and security forces. That after Sonko was detained last week over accusation of rape, igniting mass outrage at the government that led to the worst unrest in the usually tranquil West African nation. Sonko says the case is politically motivated. He was released on bail Monday pending a rape trial. Well, that's a wrap for this edition of Word News.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure,
and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The limelight.
It is despicable and unacceptable that there is not unanimous support among Democrats in Congress for a $15 minimum wage, said Representative Jamal Bowman. The listeners stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stancil, author. This article is published under the heading Shameful. Millionaire senators vote against popular minimum wage raise that would lift millions out of poverty. Here's more on that. After eight members of the Democratic caucus joined all 50 Republicans in the U.S. Senate recently to kill an amendment reattaching a $15 minimum wage provision to the Senate's coronavirus relief package, Progressive pointed out that nearly every single one of the lawmakers who voted against the raise for low-paid workers nationwide is a millionaire. Today's vote on Senator Sanders' $15 minimum wage amendment is incredibly sad. Maurice Pirrell, chair of the Patriotic Millionaires and author of the forthcoming book, Tax the Rich, said in a statement recently, "The $15 per hour is the bare minimum anyone in this country needs to survive," Pirrell continued. "And it is baffling that any member of the U.S. Senate, much less a number of Democrats, could look at the crisis this country is enduring and decide that tens of millions of low-income workers, including millions of frontline workers who put their lives on the line every day in the midst of a global pandemic, should not get a raise," he added. Nina Turner, co-chair of Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign and current candidate running for election to U.S. House in Ohio's 11th District, responded to the vote by tweeting, "Every single one of the senators who voted against raising the minimum wage is a millionaire." Journalist Ken Klippestein shared the net worth according to the most recent financial disclosures compiled by the Center for Responsive Politics of the eight Democrats who voted against Sanders' $15 minimum wage amendment. While her present net worth may trail that of other lawmakers, Senator Kyrsten Sinema was especially enthusiastic about denying a raise to millions of poorly paid U.S. workers. With her $174,000 annual salary, Sinema is well on her way to joining her wealthier colleagues in the millionaire ranks. In his statement, Pirol said that the Senate failed the American people today. Every single Republican senator who voted against $15 today failed their constituents. Pirol added, the Democrats who voted against $15 today not only failed their constituents, the decision they made to put some ancient Senate tradition ahead of the priorities that they ran on and that they stand for was wrong economically, morally, and politically, he said. Pirol was referring to the fact that Senate Democrats removed the $15 minimum wage provision from their version of the COVID-19 relief bill after the White House made clear that Vice President Kamala Harris would not be willing to exercise her authority to override the widely condemned advisory opinion of the Senate parliamentarian, an unelected official with zero constitutional authority, that deemed the proposed pay hike a violation of budget reconciliation rules. Sanders' attempt to use the amendment process to add a federal minimum wage increase to the coronavirus relief legislation came in the wake of that decision. It is despicable and unacceptable, said Representative Jamal Bowman, and he added that there is not unanimous support among Democrats in Congress for a $15 minimum wage. There is no excuse, Pirol said. Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Senator John Tester, Senator Joe Manchin, Senator Chris Kunz, Senator Jean Shaheen, Senator Tom Carper, and Maggie Hassan, both failed their people and their party. Neither those voting next year nor those reading the history of the next generation will appreciate those senators who could have changed the course of history, but chose not to. Undeterred, Sanders said recently that if any senator believes this is the last time they will cast a vote on whether or not to give a raise to 32 million Americans, they're sorely mistaken. We're going to keep bringing it up, and we're going to get it done because it is what the Americans demand and need. Joining the Sanders was Representative Pramila Jayapal, who tweeted that she will never stop fighting to make the minimum wage a living wage. It's long overdue that we give 32 million workers a raise and lift a million people out of poverty, Jayapal added.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
What would have happened if Hezbollah had been vanquished? That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and developments, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war, when considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war. One of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 2.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. In the first two episodes, we will take a stab at the first question, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? This episode deals with the wars between Israel and the Arabs, especially the battle that the Arabs started with a surprise attack. This is a story of two wars in the last century, one in 1948 and the other in 1973, an account unheard of from officers of the classic Arab armies. This story is based on investigations by the military research branch of the Islamic Resistance. The images take on a different personality when the founder of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, and its guardian, Ariel Sharon, join each other. These are very rare pictures of Sharon welcoming Ben-Gurion during his visit to the strongest line of fortifications in modern history, the Bar-Lev Line. It is a chain of Israeli fortifications built along the eastern coasts of the Suez Canal. The Bar-Lev Line was a massive, continuous sand wall that varied in height from 20 to 22 meters and spanned the entire 170-kilometer length of the canal. It was built 12 kilometers into the Sinai Peninsula and was inclined at an angle of 45 degrees. Then, Israel launched a massive propaganda campaign on the impenetrability of the wall and its superiority over France's World War II Maginot Line. Israel claimed the fortifications could destroy the Egyptian army in case they decided to pass the Suez Canal because the Bar-Lev Line was equipped with an underwater pipe system to pump flammable napalm into the canal and create a sheet of fire. But they were shocked when Egyptian special forces decided to pass the canal by blocking the pipe system. That was the beginning of one of the biggest military operations in modern history. In autumn 1973, every single Arab officer and soldier was on the battlefield holding his weapon and ready to give Israel a forceful response for the 1967 defeat. Arab nations joined forces to reach their goals. Egypt and Syria launched a simultaneous attack on Israel at 2 p.m. on October 6th. That fell on Israel's Yom Kippur feast. Artillery attacks targeted Israeli positions from the Syrian front, and thousands of Syrian forces backed by battalions of tanks headed to the Golan Heights. As the Syrian Air Force targeted the Israeli positions, Syrian troops advanced and inflicted a heavy loss and damage to the Israelis, losses that they weren't used to in former wars with the Arabs.
Before the attack, the enemy knew that it was going to be launched from the Syrian front, but doubtful about a strike from the Egyptian front. Therefore, they increased their forces at the Syrian borders. Israel sent its 7th Armored Battalion to the south of Bir al-Zaban near the Suez Canal, and in less than 24 hours, Israeli forces were ready for battle on the Golan Heights. Syria began its offensive. The Syrian army attacked the Israeli forces, which were fully prepared. Therefore, we can say we sort of broke down their defensive line, which is one of the most difficult kinds of battle.
Nothing is more difficult than the deadlock the Israeli forces faced on the battleground at Golan Heights. The army managed to destroy many of the enemy's tanks and seize some others. They were almost as good as new, as they were only driven for a few kilometers before being deployed to the Golan Heights. It is said that the tanks were rushed there from the U.S. and the Israeli army's depots. In fact, the Israeli army dispatched its entire reserve tank battalions to the front line, its entire reserve force. It implies that an important section of the Israeli armored battalions were destroyed. It was also true for the Israeli Air Force.
In the October 1973 war, the Syrian army changed the known concepts of air defense and air battle. The country's air defense forces used the SAM-6 air defense systems creatively. Therefore, more Israeli aircraft were downed on the Syrian front than on the Egyptian.
It looks those days, at the beginning, that we were caught completely by surprise. Second, the lessons of the war of attrition, especially the capability of our air force, were not learned seriously. Our air force failed in the struggle between the planes against the ground to air system.
We knew that in order to destroy one SAM, ground to air batteries, we have to pay the price of one aircraft. So if we have to destroy 25 batteries, we know that we are going to lose 25 aircrafts. You know it before you start. This is a tough decision to go there, to lose an aircraft per battery. This is how high was the threat of the missiles, that we had to go there, pay the price, destroy the batteries, and continue.
In air battle, Syrian pilots successfully targeted many Israeli phantoms in short, decisive engagements.
Almost 40% of the airplanes of my squadron were shot down during the war. In order to be able to continue, you have to build some walls, emotional walls. Pilots, unlike the legend, are human beings. And yes, there were pilots that stopped flying during the Yom Kippur War because of the situation. Not many, but the phenomena was new to us those days.
The Egyptian offensive began with mortars and missiles raining on the Barlev line, a firepower equal to 175 projectiles per second.
There were 1,500 artillery launches every minute. More than 3,000 cannons were used in the attack. Therefore, we managed to cross the Barlev line. We also prevented the enemy from employing its artillery fire and its contingency forces against us.
Egyptian infantry battalions headed toward the eastern coasts of the canal, led by a special unit of vanguard forces. They blocked the napalm pipes. Many of them were killed as a result of the burns they suffered, but they managed to provide the Egyptian troops the opportunity to cross the Suez Canal. The operation began with the Allahu Akbar, or God is Great, code, and led to the passage of the Egyptian army from the waterway, which was a historical achievement. 12 infantry battalions were set to pass the canal and head to its eastern banks within 3 hours. But only half an hour after the first invasion, the first Egyptian flag was raised on the Barlev line, and more Israeli flags were captured within a short time. After 6 hours from the beginning of the operation, 8,000 Egyptian forces crossed to the eastern banks of the canal, while the engineering units managed to set up the first floating bridge that allowed mechanized units to cross the waterway. Egyptian machinery and tanks were already heading to the eastern banks of the passage 18 hours into the conflict. In the evening of October 7th, the number of Egyptian troops that had crossed the waterway had reached 60,000. As they made the passage, Egyptian engineers were using high-pressure water pipes to create holes in the wall of the Barlev line to destroy its foundation. Consequently, Egypt gained control over the Suez Canal's eastern banks. The first hours of the October War were the longest and most difficult for the leaders of Israel since its creation. Israel had been taken aback and couldn't believe what was happening. On the second day of the war, and in compliance with the security pact between the U.S. and Israel, the U.S. directly intervened in the conflict by opening an air route for Israel. Hundreds of planes supplied Israel with its required military equipment, with daily flights carrying hundreds of tons of munitions directly to the Israeli forces on the Sinai and Golan battlefields. The Soviet Union also opened its own air route for Israel on October 10th with 84 airplanes. On the eighth day of the war, Egyptian President Anwar al-Sadat ordered Egyptian armored units to advance deep into the Sinai beyond Egypt's 12-kilometer air defense cover. The decision exposed Egyptian tanks to Israeli military aircraft. Sadat took the risk despite opposition by many of the officers on the battlefield, led by Chief of Staff Saadeddine al-Shazli. Later, Sadat tried to justify his plan, saying he wanted to reduce pressure on the Syrian front.
حصل يوم 14 كان بيعتمد على اساس دفع الفرقه ال 21 والفرقه الرابعه المدرعه من غرب الخناق الى الشرق.
Sadat's decision on October 14 relied on the success of the 21st and 4th Egyptian Army divisions to cross to the east of the canal. So when we didn't make it, only 400 tanks were left for the offensive. Look at the poor planning here. We had only 400 tanks against the enemy's 900 tanks, and they had air supremacy. How is it possible that such a plan turns out successful? On that day, we lost 250 out of the initial 400 tanks, and the enemy gained the upper hand. Now, did we reduce pressure on the Syrian front after such a blow to our forces and retreat into Egypt's air defense cover? No. We didn't.
These rare pictures show Israeli fighter jets heading to target Egyptian tanks out of the range of Egypt's SAM-6 anti-aircraft missile system as Israeli tanks close in on Egypt's armored personnel carriers and destroy them one by one. It was happening as Sadat was heading to Egypt's National Assembly to tell the world about the Arab army's spectacular victory against Israel.
Egypt's armed forces made a miracle come true at all military levels.
Despite Egypt's failure in the Battle of the Tanks, the Arabs had the upper hand in the war on the Sinai. Today, when Arab commanders talk of the Arab army's victory in the 1973 war, they pick an 8-day episode out of an 18-day conflict during which the Israeli army was on the defensive. But from the 10th day on, Israelis gradually began to adopt an offensive tactic. Shrewdly and efficiently, they switched their strategy. In the evening of October 15th, a small group of seven Israeli tanks made it across the western banks of the Suez Canal to lay siege to Egypt's 3rd Army Division. The move, which later came to be known as the Split, divided the Egyptian army into two separate halves. The two parts were the Egyptian Army's 2nd Division deployed on the northern side of the canal's eastern banks, and the 3rd Army Division on the southern side of the eastern banks, and the Split targeted the 3rd Division with the siege. An Israeli force of 330 tanks led by Sharon moved to the western banks of the canal, encircling the Egyptian army's 3rd Division, an enclosure that remained in place for 100 days, even after the end of the war. Sharon's forces also laid siege to the cities bordering the waterway, especially Ismailia and Suez.
All Arab armies joined forces to launch a surprise attack on Israel, but the Israeli army quickly robbed the opportunity the surprise attack had given them. The Arab forces had planned to attack the eastern banks of the Suez Canal, but it was Israel that eventually invaded the canal's western banks. The Egyptian army consisted of the 2nd and 3rd Divisions, and each division was comprised of 5 brigades. The 5 brigades of the 3rd Division were fully surrounded by Israeli forces, leaving the route to Cairo open to the Israelis. Also on the Syrian front, the road to Damascus would have been opened if it was not for the presence of Iraqi and Jordanian forces.
Sharon's forces were there in their full numbers. He had 2 armored brigades, but they failed. He failed in his mission to take over Ismailia. A parachute brigade and 2 commando battalions stood up to the Israeli armored units. It is a great Egyptian lesson of defense.
The Egyptian and Israeli sides met at a point just 101 kilometers away from Cairo, where Sharon's armored brigade had managed to advance to during the war. They signed an end-of-conflict resolution that led to the withdrawal of 100,000 Egyptian troops and more than 1,000 of their tanks from the eastern banks of the Suez Canal to their initial pre-war positions on the canal's western banks. The resolution authorized Egypt to keep only 7,000 forces and 30 tanks on the eastern banks of the waterway.
I should openly say that Sadat thought this is only an act of provocation, while Syria and Hafez Assad considered it a liberation war, which were 2 completely opposite viewpoints. From the first day of the war, Sadat and Kissinger were in contact and talked about the Egyptian army's key crossing of the Suez Canal and how to stop the war and enter negotiations. This is why Syria almost fought the war alone, except for a few days that Egypt changed its mind and decided to engage in the battle, and even that was not a serious engagement.
Despite the Syrian forces' strong resistance and sacrifices, Israel's mounting pressure on the Golan Front forced the Syrian army to return to the lands it held at the beginning of the conflict. In fact, Israel even managed to occupy more territories than it held after the 1967 war. This is a map of the lands controlled by Israel in 1967 and the extra territories they seized in 1973. It also shows Israeli forces' advancement toward Damascus and the western Suez areas they occupied on the eve of the 1973 war resolution. In spite of the Syrian army's heavy losses, the Syrian president Hafez al-Assad stood firm against U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. They held 130 hours of negotiations in the spring of 1974. Following the negotiations, Israel agreed to pull out of a vast area of land it had occupied in October 1973, to the point that Assad declared Al-Quneitra liberated.
هل كان كان هدف الحرب الأساسي هو التحرير أو التحرير؟
Was liberation the main objective of the war, or was it an act of provocation to ensure political gains? Or was the war meant to achieve a small victory to get even with Israel? This is what war meant, at least for Egypt, not for Syria. But none of these matter. I think the military aspect should be taken into consideration the moment when Arabs decided to enter the battle, be it for honorable ends or not. They decided on the time and the place where the battle was to be started and enjoyed enforcements from Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Iraq, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Syria. All of them participated in the 1973 offensive. If back in 1967, their governments, officials, and armies could argue that they were on the defensive because they were attacked by the enemy, they had no argument of the sort in 1973. At the time, they initiated the war and were superior to Israel at a ratio of at least 10 to 1 in all spheres. But rather than gaining a clear and decisive victory to set the stage for future gains, they only settled for the imaginative victory of surprising Israel for 18 hours. Thanks to this security and military strategy, Israelis got things in their hands after the 18-hour shocker. The enemy was back, took over the battlefield, and turned Arabs' victory into a military defeat. It also humiliated Egypt's 3rd Army Division by their siege.
The Arab government's 1973 war raised hopes, or at least the possibility, that it would open a new front against Israel. But the Arabs' failures and the outcome of the war made it the final unsuccessful move against Israel that spread a feeling of desperation among a large portion of people in the Arab world.
Let us promise each other that we shall do it earlier than between 2 and 5.
The whole experience with Menachem Begin is continuing. I can't tell until the end of it. We are just in the middle of it. Menachem is my friend, for sure. We are friends. This is a fact.
You're a man of peace, but yet you can be a man of aggression.
That's right.
Some people were shaken up by Sadat's visit, but I should only reiterate that this movement is stronger than being affected by a visit or any such thing.
Limelight. Vaccination doesn't 100% prevent you from getting infected, but in all cases it gives your immune system a huge leg up on the coronavirus. Whatever your outcome, whether complete protection from infection or some level of disease, you will be better off after encountering the virus than if you hadn't been vaccinated. We have prepared for you an article written by Deborah Fuller. The piece is titled, Can Vaccinated People Still Spread the Virus? The article has been taken from the Conversation website. Please stay with us for more of Deborah Fuller's article. So you've got your coronavirus vaccine, you've waited the 2 weeks for your immune system to respond to the shot, and are now fully vaccinated. Does this mean you can make your way through the world like the old days without fear of spreading the virus? Deborah Fuller is a microbiologist at the University of Washington School of Medicine, working on coronavirus vaccines. She explains what the science shows about transmission post-vaccination and whether new variants of the virus could change this equation. Question number one, does vaccination completely prevent infection? The short answer is no. You can still get infected after you've been vaccinated, but your chances of getting seriously ill are almost zero. Many people think vaccines work like a shield, blocking a virus from infecting cells altogether. But in most cases, a person who gets vaccinated is protected from disease, not necessarily infection. Every person's immune system is a little different, so when a vaccine is 95% effective, that just means 95% of people who receive the vaccine won't get sick. These people could be completely protected from infection, or they could be getting infected but remain asymptomatic because their immune system eliminates the virus very quickly. The remaining 5% of vaccinated people, though, can become infected and get sick, but are extremely unlikely to be hospitalized. Vaccination doesn't 100% prevent you from getting infected, but in all cases, it gives your immune system a huge leg up on the coronavirus. Whatever your outcome, whether complete protection from infection or some level of disease, you will be better off after encountering the virus than if you hadn't been vaccinated. Question number two, does infection always mean transmission? Transmission happens when enough viral particles from an infected person get into the body of an uninfected person. In theory, anyone infected with the coronavirus could potentially transmit it, but a vaccine will reduce the chance of this happening.